The following is a meeting with devotees with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, recorded on January 7th, 2001, in Dublin, Ireland.
I would like to speak a kind of sequel to a talk I gave on my birthday. I'll review that a little first. I was saying that devotees are in ISKCON and what is now different offshoots from ISKCON are more and more interested in making advancement in understanding their eternal relationship with Krishna. Prabhupada, of course, warned not to do this immaturely or artificially, to jump up to the, especially to the conjugal pastimes of Radha and Krishna. Although this is our eternal, inherent, constitutional nature. So I was saying that, although I was speaking personally, I have a taste for hearing these literatures and for thinking of Vrindavan and going to Vrindavan, separation from Vrindavan. But I emphasized that as important or even more important is to know the truth. And that would mean, among other things, the truth about oneself. We can say to know the truth means to know Krishna. He is objectively, he's the absolute truth. And our relationship with Krishna is the truth. But I meant more our failings, the truth in that sense. The truth, which if we know it, makes us humble, and then shows us also the distance we have before we can reach understanding Raganuga Bhakti, and should, we hope, not depress us, but make us earnest to do the real work that has to be done. So I think there's a lot I could say in a whole series of classes about this, thinking of how humility can lead us to examining different anarthas and how to remedy them. So first a little bit more about this humility and how it cuts away with a pretentious understanding we may have of our spiritual advancement. I wanted to read a selection from a book called The Wisdom of the Desert, which is a collection of sayings by Christian monks who went to get away from the world in the 4th century. They lived in the desert, and some of them lived in caves and very austere conditions. And somewhat like the yogis who went to the Himalayas and practiced yoga there. So these are some of their sayings. This is one I picked out for appropriate for what I'm discussing today. There was a certain elder who had fasted valiantly for 50 years and said, "I have put out the flames of lust and avarice and vainglory." Abbot Abraham heard about it and came to him asking, "Did you really say that?" "I did," he replied. Then Abbot Abraham said, "So, you go into your cell and there is a woman lying on your mat. Can you think that she is not a woman?" He said, "No, but I fight my thoughts so that I don't touch that woman." "Then," said Abbot Abraham, "you have not killed fornication. The passion is alive, but it is bound. And now supposing you are on a journey, and in the road among the stones and broken pottery you see some gold. Can you think of it as if it were like the other stones?" "No," he replied, "but I resist my thoughts so that I do not pick it up." Then Abbot Abraham said, "You see, the passion is alive, but it is bound." Then Abbot Abraham said again, "You hear about two brothers, of whom one likes you and speaks well of you, and the other hates you and speaks evil of you. They come to you, and do you receive them both alike?" "No," he replied, "but I am tormented inside, trying to be just as nice to the one who hates me as I am to the other." Abbot Abraham said, The passions live then, but in the saints they are only, to some extent, bound. Of course, we believe in saints who go further than this, and for whom that very example is given in Bhagavad Gita, for whom gold and stone are the same. But here he says even the saint can have passions. But he had reached an advanced stage where he wouldn't act in the presence of a woman for sex. He would not act to take gold. And he would not, well, he said he could not help himself in favoring the friend over the enemy, but he would feel very bad about it. He would be tormented to see that he had failed to treat them equally. So in this case, the abbot humbled him, but even made that concluding statement that at least we can say in the saints the passions are bound. And one shouldn't be ashamed to admit this, if this is his level of control. At least it's something, rather than be pretentious. There's another story from this same tradition where, because these persons were fasting and praying, they sometimes had extraordinary experiences, visions and that sort of thing. So in one community, the brothers ran to the abbot and they said, Brother so-and-so is having visions of angels. So the abbot said, he was not at all impressed. And he said, I am interested to hear and to see someone who is seeing his sins, seeing within himself his sins rather than seeing other kinds of visions. And in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, there is a lot of expression of this fallen nature. In the songs of Narottam Das Thakur, some of them are grouped into what's called Dainya Bodhika, which are, in some of the translations, it says, where the author admits his fallen condition. And then he says these very strong things about his fallen condition, that I never, even for a second, was attracted to Sanatana Goswami, Rupa Goswami, Swarup Damodar, and so on. And he says, Krishnadas Kaviraj, if anyone reads his Chaitanya Charitamrita or Govinda Lilamrita, he will cry. His books can melt even the stones, but I am not affected by reading his books. So he admits these things about himself. And on the other hand, groups of his songs come under the name Lalasmayi, which is yearning for being with Krishna in one's particular relationship. He expresses that I yearn for the time when I can be with my spiritual master, and he is in the form of a Sakhi, and together we're rendering service to Radha and Krishna. So he has both kinds of expression. But one is very advanced, kind of longing, and the other is a very heartfelt admittance of fallen condition. So one has to be honest about his own ability to feel lalasmayi. You have to have a large degree of greed for that position, and you have to be pure. So in getting mileage out of this topic, I would like to talk today on just one weakness, and that's the fear. Fear is one of the four animal propensities: eating, mating, sleeping, and fearing or defending. And Prabhupada says of these four, this is the most prominent. You've heard him describe that even a bird, when he's eating food, he's looking this way and that way, is somebody coming? And even the most powerful country like the United States, they were afraid, oh, Russia may come, Vietnamese may come. So even these big nations with their nuclear weapons are always afraid. anxiety. So I would like to discuss this a little bit, and first in an ordinary way, and then leading up to the Shastras, Prabhupada's books, and how to deal with it. Aside from general fears, there are fears, that particular fears that people have that other people may not have. They're called phobias, and they're usually described by just putting in front of them such and such phobia, such and such phobia, and they're characterized by having a panic feeling when you're near this thing or when you confront this, and you just with a very strong desire to get away from it. For example, like claustrophobia is a fear of being in very narrow places. I had an experience of this a couple of years ago when I was in America. I went for a test in connection with my headaches. I wanted to test whether it was something more serious than headaches, whether I had any brain tumors. So I went for this test. It's called the MRI. That's a more sophisticated version of a CAT scan, in case you've heard that. So I was taken to all these things by Baladev and Madhurya Leela. She's a nurse in Johns Hopkins Hospital. So she was taking care of me, almost a little overdoing it. And so when we got to this place, she said that, but before you enter this MRI, I'm going to ask him if he'll give you a little Valium. Valium is a tranquilizer. So I didn't object. So then when we got there waiting for it, then the doctor who's involved with giving it, he wasn't inclined to give it. So then I met with him and I said, well, is it standard that a person takes Valium when he goes into this? He said, no. He said, come, I'll show you. So he showed me somebody was already in there. I had a CAT scan before, so I knew what it was. But I saw this MRI. The person, you get inside this big cigar-shaped metal machine, and you have to lie in there for about 45 minutes, and you can't move the slightest degree because what it's doing is taking pictures. And every few moments, you're just lying there silently, but every few moments, the pictures are being taken, and when they're being taken, it sounds like a machine gun. It goes like that. And then again, it's quiet. So he said, so that's what it is. He said, do you have claustrophobia? I said, no, I don't. But after all this fuss with Madhurya Leela asking, you know, and so he said, well, I'll give you half of a dose of Valium. So I don't have claustrophobia. But anyway, I went in that machine, and they even put a piece of tape across your forehead so you would feel it if you made the slightest movement to help you to be completely clear. So I just paid attention to my breaths during that time, and I didn't have any difficulty. And the technician complimented me. Oh, you're excellent. Subject. But if you did have claustrophobia, it would be a kind of irrational fear. There's nothing going to hurt you about being in that situation. But this panic would come. I suppose they may come from having some initial bad experience in some way. And psychologists, they undo these fears. So a little more ordinary talk before we move on to Shastra. But this is I'll give you another example of something which shows a psychological way to remove fear. A phobia I did have when I was very small was a fear of dogs. I don't know what it's called. Maybe Abhay knows, canine phobia or something. I emphasize I was small because I remember the dogs were bigger than me when I grew up in Queens, New York City. It was a very working class, urban, congested neighborhood. So like in India, it's not that the dogs were always out on a leash, and they would come up to you barking. I even remember once this dog was on a leash. A man came with a Great Dane dog, and he was bounding down the street, and he was much bigger than me. like seeing, like coming across an elephant. And another time a dog came at me, threatening me and growling and barking. And I ran inside one of the buildings, and I was looking out the mail slot, waiting for when he would go away. I was so afraid. So my parents noticed this panic fear I had whenever I saw a dog. And I remember one night I was driving with them. I was in the back seat, and my uncle was there, Uncle Sal, and he said, "I have something for you," and he placed in the back seat of the car, in a little box, a puppy, and he said, "This is a puppy. This is your puppy, for you." And right away, I wasn't afraid of him, because he was so small and he was so affectionate, and so this was. It was a family dog, but it was supposed to be my dog, and we gave him a name, Mickey. And then I remember being out in the street with him. I was real proud. I had this dog on a leash. So that was very clever, applying psychology. But because a lot of the time the phobia goes back, whatever it goes back to, you have to face it and get a little bit of it. I remember reading about a lady who was bitten all over her body by bees. And now if she saw a bee in any proximity, she would scream and run away. And so through psychotherapy, they had her, I don't know, somehow face thinking of one bee and dealing with the bee and so on. It's not such a terrible thing to remove the thing that had set in. So you may be starting to think of many, many fears that you have had or may still have, and how they may restrict us from leading a full life, because we're always trying to ward off life, thinking it can around the corner one of these fears may be popping up. Fear of not having enough money, and fear of not performing in this way or that way rightly. To churn it up a little more, I would like to read a poem that came upon recently. It's by a contemporary American poet. Her name is Dorian Lowe, and it's called Fear. I'll refrain from making any comment because I'd like to make a comment afterwards, but let the poem speak for itself. Just to say, however, though, since it's written by a woman, it's written about her childhood. It tells of a girl's childhood, and it would be just in that sense, it would be different from a boy's memories. We were afraid of everything: earthquakes, strangers, smoke above the canyon, the fire that would come running and eat up our house, the Claymore girls, big-boned, rough, razor blades tucked in their ratted hair. We were terrified of polio, tuberculosis, being found out, the tent full of boys, two blocks over, the kickball, the asphalt, the pain-filled rocks, the glass-littered canyon, the deep cave gouged in its side, the wheelbarrow crammed with dirty magazines, beer cans, spit-laced butts. We were afraid of hands, screen doors slammed by angry mothers, abandoned cars, their slumped back seats, the chain-link fence we couldn't climb fast enough, electric storms, blackouts, girl fights behind the pancake house, original sin, sidewalk cracks and the corner crematorium, loose brakes on the handlebars of our bikes. It came alive behind our eyes. Ant mounds, wasps' nests, the bird half eaten on the scratchy grass, chained dogs, the boggy creek bed, the sewer main that fed it, the game where you had to hold your breath until you passed out. We were afraid of being poor, dumb, yelled at, ignored, invisible, as the nuclear dust we were told to wipe from lids before we opened them in the kitchen. The fat roll of meat that slid into the pot. Sleep, dreams, the soundless swing of the father's ringed fist. The mother's face turned away. The wet bed, anything red, the slow leak, the stain on the driveway, oily gears soaking in a shallow pan. Busted chairs stuffed in the rafters of the neighbor's garage. The Chevy's twisted undersides jacked up on blocks. Wrenches left scattered in the dirt. It was what we knew best, understood least. It whipped through our bodies like fire or sleet. We were lured by the dumpster behind the liquor store, fissures in the baked earth, the smell of singed hair, the brassy hum of high-tension towers, train tracks, buzzards over a ditch, black widows, the cat with one eye, the red spot on the back of the skirt, the fallout shelter's metal door hinged to the rusty grass, the back way, the wrong path, the night's wide back, the coiled springs of the sister's top bunk, the wheezing, the cousin in the next room tapping on the wall, anything small. We were afraid of clothesline, curtain rods, the worn hairbrush, the good-for-nothings we were about to become. Reform school, the long ride to the ocean on the bus, the man at the back of the bus, the underpass. We were afraid of fingers of pickleweed crawling over the embankment, the French kiss, the profound silence of dead fish, burning sand, rotting elastic in the waistbands of our underpants, jellyfish, riptides, eucalyptus bark unraveling, the pink flesh beneath the stink of seaweed, seagulls landing near our feet, their hateful eyes, their orange-tipped beaks stabbing the sand, the crumbling edge of the continent we stood on, wanting to be saved, the endless wind-driven waves. I forget what it is I wanted to say about it, except it's essentially a list. This one way that poems are written. What did I want to say is it's just, you could write a poem too, like this, and just let it all pour out. Your poem might be made up of completely different items, but this shows how all these things are actually within us, and if we remembered them, it seems that, wow, as you said, it's the thing we knew best. You're always afraid. There's so many things that you're afraid of. Perhaps children are they more afraid? When you grow up, we learn not to be afraid of some of those things, but then you're afraid of other things. And so fear is the most prominent. I made up a little list of fears of my own, and maybe I'll read some of them. I didn't make them in any particular order, or maybe unconsciously they are. When I finish this talk, I'm going to ask you also to speak of any fears you have and how you dealt with them in Krishna Conscious, because I'm going to be reading scripture where it tells how to deal with fears. Here's a list of some fears of mine. One, the court case and all that may happen as it unravels in its nitty-gritty to ISKCON and as it applies to me. This reminds me of the discussion of how karma is in different stages. In one stage, it's something we did in the past, but we haven't suffered for yet. Another stage, we're suffering for it now. Another stage is going to happen in the future. So this court case is like that. It's already happening, but it hasn't really happened in its full. The guilt, the sins, or the mistakes of ISKCON were committed. They're starting to get reaction, but the full reaction hasn't come yet. You can get in a lot of anxiety in a state like that. I remember when I first heard about this case breaking and how enormous and fearful it was. One thing I did was I had to decide whether I would write about it, since I write every day, I write about things. I was almost afraid that legally I shouldn't write about it. But I decided, just to be true to the writing commitment, I should write about what counted or what I was afraid of. That's even one of the rules in free writing. If something scary comes up, go for it. Because that's where the energy is, and continue to write this. So this is a fear. Number two, being stopped in my basic direction. That refers to the direction that I'm going in now with writing and living mostly alone, leading a creative life. That something or other would stop me. 3, everything is wrong again as it was in guru reform. I won't comment. 4, of my death and terrible shortcomings then in not thinking of Krishna. I think we all have this fear that we won't be advanced enough at the time of death. I have a recurring dream that I'm back in the Navy and I'm back at the same occupation I had as a journalist. And I've had this dream so often, and it's usually not so bad. It's just I'm coming back and I hope to get the same status that I had instead of being a newcomer. Things have changed, but I'm meeting new people. So I take it that this recurring dream has to do with reincarnation, and that I'm afraid that I'm going to have to come back into the material world again. So that's a fear, and it comes out in different ways. Afraid the headaches will just increase, as well as my medicating them. Afraid to discover it's actually rebound headache and there's no alternative but to wean off rescue meds again. Afraid of pain. Afraid of failing in human endurance tests. Fear of getting caught in wars, being held hostage, economic collapse, no heating, no food, etc. All and any threats to bodily and mental well-being. Plane crash, any sudden death. This is also a I don't have a phobia about planes. I remember there was one person, a very popular novelist of these horror novels. I don't even remember his name. But he had a terrible fear of flying, and he would never take an airplane. And he was like a millionaire, and he had so many calls and opportunities to fly, but he wouldn't do it. I think he lived in England. But that would be an example of a phobia. I'm sure we all, when we get on the plane, we may, you know, at some point we think, well, I hope this isn't going to happen, and we chant Hare Krishna as we feel any fear. But some people wouldn't even get on the plane. Fear fall down from sannyas, attacked by critics of my writing and me, accept what they say. Oh, and I accept what they say. Okay, so exposing some of my personal fears. Now, let's take a look at the Shastra. Looking for the word fear in the Bhagavad Gita, and going through the Bhagavad Gita, there's some interesting themes come up. It comes up right away in the first chapter among the Kshatriyas. Generally, we think that Kshatriyas are not afraid, but there's a number of expressions that they were afraid. Duryodhan went to his commander-in-chief to ask what is the situation about the enemy and the size of their army. And Prabhupada writes, Duryodhan's diplomatic veneer could not disguise the fear he felt when he saw the military arrangement of the Pandavas. Of the four orders, they're fearless. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, you may remember the Bengalis, they were afraid when the Pathan Muslims stopped them. Lord Chaitanya was unconscious, and the Bengalis and some other person were with him, and they were very frightened, but the other Vaishnava wasn't. But even Duryodhan was afraid, because there were causes of fear, it says. They are mentioned by Duryodhan. These are great stumbling blocks on the path of victory. When Bhishma, then here's another point. When Bhishma and the others on the side of Duryodhan blew their conch shells, it doesn't mention that it was heartbreaking to the other side. But when Krishna, and not just Krishna, but when the Pandavas, whole group, when they blow their conches, it shatters the hearts of the other side. Now here's Now here's the first positive point. One who takes shelter of the Supreme Lord has nothing to fear, even in the midst of the greatest calamity. Now, this is good to read in the context of Bhagavad Gita, because we're on the side of the Pandavas. But it may just be dogma for you in your own life. But this is what we have to learn. How, when we have fear, to turn to Krishna. By chanting his holy name, by calling to Krishna. And I think I can speak not only for myself, but for other devotees, in that we have reached a point where we're not fearless, but we do turn to Krishna. It's brought out that we have a relationship with Krishna when this fearful situation comes. I described the little boy myself running in fear from the dog, running inside the house, looking out the mail slot, having no shelter, no recourse, but fear itself. But now we have Krishna, and even if we are afraid, even if we do run, we call out to Krishna to please save me, and we don't just live with fear. During World War II, President Roosevelt tried to assure the American people, and he said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. So that applies to devotees especially. We have nothing to fear because we have Krishna. But if we are afraid, it's because we're afraid of fear. Sounds strange to say we're afraid of fear, but we become immersed in the illusion of fear. We'll read a little about more why this happens. Arjuna had no cause to fear because he was with Krishna. But then, as you know, Arjuna is described in two different ways. So he's trembling of the body and his hairs are standing on end, but that's either ecstasy or it's fear. There's no fear in transcendental realization. Arjuna's symptoms in this situation are out of material fear, namely loss of life. So he gave up his duty and sat down on the chariot. What happened, Aniruddha? Have a motorcycle accident? We're looking through the Bhagavad Gita right now on occasions of fear. So this is an important point, that even if you are afraid, therefore Arjuna as a Kshatriya should not abandon his duty out of fear that his grandfather and teacher, Bhishma and Drona, will die in the battle. So, Kshatriyas sometimes may admit that they have fear for anybody, but they have to do their duty. Matra sparshas tukantaya shitoshna sukadukada. Even in the cold weather, you can't be afraid or reluctant to bathe, and in the hot weather, you have to cook in the hot kitchen. This is another response to fear in terms of Krishna conscious duty. Remembering Krishna and the transcendental security you have to go ahead even in the face of fear. Now, in the situation with Arjuna, Krishna says that his cowardly avoidance of the fight, that's what he did, would be worse than death. So it's this is such a not only for the Kshatriya, but if we give up our commitment to Krishna consciousness, it's worse than death. For one who has been honored, dishonor is worse than death, especially the dishonor of no longer taking shelter in Krishna. And then later he says about bhakti, in this endeavor there is no loss or diminution, and a little advancement on this path can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. I always assume that this means death itself. The most But I suppose it could mean various kinds of fear that are considered the most dangerous. But the greatest fear that we have is the fear of loss of life. So, if you perform a bhakti, then even if loss of life comes now, death is coming, you won't be simply in a phobia, a death phobia. There is such a thing, again, I wouldn't know the word for it, but a person who is obsessed with death. I remember a person like that telling me that he saw death, probably we're rather dull to it, we don't see it, but this person and similar persons, they see death at every corner. They become very, very afraid that something is going to cause them to die. And as a result, they are practically paralyzed to all activity. So this is an obsession with that which is ultimately the greatest fear, but it has become unleashed in an irrational way so that they can't even perform daily duties. Because if we think like that, we can't go out, we can't go to work, you can't eat, you can't do anything, because you're afraid that death may come at any moment, which it may. But the devotee, he should be unafraid of death. And even as it approaches, then he should take shelter. Now it's coming, the great fear of my life is coming. Let me take shelter in Krishna and give up all other distracting activities. Unfortunately, the devotee community helps us at that time to do the ideal things, to surround ourselves with chanting and hearing, and to assure us that if we die in Krishna consciousness, this is the best possible thing. And then the person can die, I won't say peacefully, but not like a cat or dog, but with awareness of Krishna and the eternal soul. Now here are some essential definitions of fear in the Bhagavad Gita. Fear is due to worrying about the future. A person in Krishna consciousness has no fear because by his activities he is sure to go back to the spiritual sky, back to home, back to Godhead. Therefore his future is very bright. Others, however, do not know what their future holds. They have no knowledge of what the next life holds, so they are in constant anxiety. Now that anxiety may be about the void. Of they don't know what's really going to come next. And so they take to intoxication and try to live this one life as happy as possible. But every once in a while, they just see there's nothing to it. And they become afraid of their lack of identity, of lack of purpose in life, unless they really get intoxicated more and more. So, and Prabhupada says like that, now we may not be able to guarantee that we're going to go back to Godhead at the end of this life. And so we have a justified fear that we should try in the face of this to make as much advancement as possible and make it the great priority of our lives. But at the end of life, we'll be very sorry that we didn't. When the great fear comes. More essential definitions. Fear is caused by our absorption in the illusory energy. Those who are free from the illusory energy, those who are confident that they're not the material body, that they're spiritual parts of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and who are therefore engaged in the transcendental service of the Lord, have nothing to fear. Their future is very bright. This fear is a condition of persons who are not in Krishna consciousness. Abhayam, fearlessness, is possible only for one in Krishna consciousness. So the more you think that you're the body, you're afraid because different things will come to threaten and trouble you because I am this body. We have to practice in different ways to make this theoretical knowledge that we have somewhat real. Don't just act always on the bodily fearful platform. Take a step off immersion in the material energy and do something daring for Krishna. And when you do that and you see that Krishna holds you up and you really didn't have to be afraid, then it's like a child. You may not have confidence that he can ride a bicycle or can do this or that, and they do it and they get some confidence. When we get take shelter in Krishna in some fearful situation, then we can do that thing again. Next time we can do it with some confidence that, well, I'm not this body, so I can do this thing, and Krishna will protect me. The Bhagavad Gita also tells about Krishna's Arjuna's fear of the universal form and his desire to see. So that brings out the fact that God himself is, he causes great fear. He's so awesome and fearful. Some people worship God that way. The other morning, I heard about it in advance. There was going to be a shower of meteors early Wednesday morning. I went out and I waited. Of course, in Ireland, there's such a dark covering, you couldn't see them. It was very unusual. It was a very starry. They started at 5 a.m. And I watched and watched. The sky was full of stars. And I didn't see anything. And then suddenly I saw this huge light streak down from the sky. It was so bright. And I became very afraid and in awe. And so that's the universal form, or that's one aspect of God, his powerful nature, which at any moment can upset our notions that everything is in place and we're in the center. And then the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita: abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. I shall deliver you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear. The particular words used here, masucha, don't fear, don't hesitate, don't worry. So this is in the context. If you think that by surrendering to Krishna completely and giving up other kinds of morality, you may be to blame. Sometimes devotees worry about that. What about my allegiance to my parents and society and my economic situation? If I just surrender to Krishna, won't I be in trouble? He says, don't be afraid. I will take care of that. It's useless to worry. Krishna will take care of you. Before I ask you to speak, I have a few more shastras. It's kind of comforting to hear for myself, since I am often fearful, as I gave you in that list, to hear that sometimes great devotees in their pastimes are afraid. In the Chaitanya Bhagavat, we read how the great kirtans were held at Srivas Pandi's house, but outside the Pasandis, they were very angry and because they weren't let in. And they were blaspheming. They said they would break down Srivas Pandi's house and that the king, they'd start a rumor that the king was going to come and destroy him and arrest his family. So all the kirtans were taking place in his house, and he became a little afraid. What I'm reading from, it's a summary of the chapter before the verses begin. Sachidev is mentioned also as having reverential fear for her son rather than motherly affection. That's particularly when he was acting very in madness, and she couldn't understand what he was doing, so it put her into reverential fear. So the performance of all-night kirtan began. The Pasandis were angered. They were filled with anger, especially against Srivas, which led them to spread false rumors on the king's displeasure. The Lord then removed Srivas' fears with his words of assurance. He showed his divine four-armed form to Srivas. Srivas was relieved of all his fears by beholding all these divine manifestations, and he chanted the glories of the Lord. So, if you are afraid of some situation and you pray to Krishna, and then Krishna reveals himself to you in some way or other, then you say, oh, I'm Krishna has given me protection. He assures me I should go on with this activity, even though there's some threat, I should go on and he will protect me. That was what happened there. Now, in the 10th canto, we hear about Vasudeva and Devaki's fear of Kamsa, especially then when the baby Krishna was born. They're afraid that, like all the other babies, Kamsa would come and kill this baby. Prabhupada, he writes about this in terms of himself and the Krishna consciousness movement. Public officers declare without hesitation that the chanting of the Hare Krishna movement is a nuisance, although Bhagavad Gita says we should always chant. And he mentions Vasudeva and says, similarly, although the Krishna consciousness movement and Krishna are not different, and no asuras can check it, we are afraid that at any moment the asuras can stop this movement in any part of the world. Prabhupada was getting news from all different places. I think around this time his movement was shut down by the So Devaki and another purport, Devaki and Vasudeva were afraid. Similarly, we are astounded upon thinking whether this movement will be killed by the asuras or whether it will continue to advance without fear. And I have just a final reference of, this is a very practical one, of what to do when fear comes by the best devotees of Krishna, the gopis. It's the same. This is a seventh canto about fear is being described. I forget the context. But there's a discussion of fear, and then Vishwanath Chakravarti brings up the gopis. The word bayena means fear. When the gopis went to Krishna in the dead of night, they certainly feared chastisement by their relatives, their husbands, brothers, and fathers. But nonetheless, not caring for their relatives, they went to Krishna. There was certainly fear, but this fear could not check their devotional service to Krishna. I don't think we usually think that there was even fear for the gopis. They just heard the flute and whoosh, out they went in their spiritual bodies. But here, when you think of it, there are expressions of that. Oh, what will our brothers say? What will our fathers say? But they go anyway to answer the flute call of Krishna. So we should give each other fearlessness. We should encourage each other to do our duties, despite things that are fearful, irrationally, in our minds, or which are actually situations that appear fearful in the world. Krishna. So I can try to answer some questions this may have brought up, but I thought it might be good if first at least a few devotees, if they, while this is being discussed, they thought, oh, I have something I would like to tell about a situation where I became fearful and how I was able to respond in a Krishna conscious way.
Actually, I just read recently in the Bhagavad Gita, which helped me enormously. And I think it's a fear that most devotees can relate to. It's in the 18th chapter of Prabhupada. He uses this, I was just so surprised, he just said that, you know, blatantly or blankly, a person in Krishna consciousness shouldn't fear that his activities are fruitive, and he compared it with getting up in the morning. Same thing. You shouldn't give these up because they're troublesome.
No.
Because that's renunciation in the mode of passion, and renunciation in the mode of passion. If we act in that spirit, we won't receive the results of renunciation.
Hmm.
And I thought, that's such a, like, that covers my life, my biggest fear, almost like daily, or, you know, every second you're free to act, because you're thinking, is this Krishna consciousness, is this just like, is this some crazy thing that I'm doing? That, you know, is this authorized? Is this, I suppose, if you, especially if you grow up in a temple, it's understandable maybe.
Yeah.
Think like that, but I thought that was such a. Just recently, I read that. And
unfortunately, that fear sometimes comes from other devotees who impose it on you. They say that what you're doing isn't bona fide, and then you become afraid. We can't act if we're like that, crippled and intimidated all the time. So that's a real fear, and then your whole life will go by, and you won't have really used your energy full force in serving Krishna. To some fear. Yes.
Just admiring how you listen to your list of fears, and I felt that, well, I would be afraid to admit such a thing. And so that's probably the strong fear I would list it. I would be afraid to list the fear.
Afraid of being found out that you're afraid of anything. Yeah, well, when we bring them out, then we can deal with them. That poem began remembering that we were afraid of everything. But if you say I'm not afraid of anything, then what are you afraid of? Write a poem of what you're afraid of. No, there's nothing I can think of. And we say, well, what's the benefit of admitting all these things? Perhaps no benefit unless you, like anything else, can face it and make the best out of it in Krishna consciousness. If you have a fear of heights, okay, it's not that you have, then you don't ever have to go... climb a high building or go to the Himalayas, just stay at Govardhan Hill or something. It's not that we have to root out all these material fears and phobias, but some of the, you can live with yourself much better by facing some of these fears. And some of them can actually be put aside and say, well, I don't have to be afraid of that. It's not, I'm worrying about something that's not even my responsibility to be afraid, to even deal with that. So there are different reasons why admitting your fears can be helpful. Some of them you can just laugh at as not really being fearful, and some of them, well, then you just have to live with, like the fear of death. Say, well, then. I should become Krishna conscious. That fear I expressed of my own, that I'll be caught at the time of death, terribly unprepared and not at all unadvanced, not at all advanced in Krishna consciousness or thinking of Krishna at the end. So then I should start to peel off any other attachments that I have that aren't conducive to that, to that state that I say I want to be in at the end. Someone else had a hand up.
As you were speaking about me, at my work, it's sometimes I work at a homeless shelter, and some of the men there are extremely violent people, and there's been a couple times where, like a couple weeks ago, I remember one of the men locked himself in the dining room, and we called the police because we couldn't get him out, and the police showed up and they saw the situation, they called more police, so there were seven police people there, and then the first thing he said to me and the other person who was on duty, who was about my same size, he said, well, we can't do anything. We can only back you up. You have to go in there and throw them out. And I was thinking, like, how do I know that Krishna is, like, how do I know for sure that Krishna is going to be, like, protecting me in this situation? I felt like, am I really under Krishna's protection since I'm, you know, I don't know, maybe I had, like,
is this a Krishna conscious thing to do?
Is this a Krishna conscious situation I've put myself in? I'm not directly serving Krishna. Is he really going to protect me? And my big fear was, like, you know, am I outside of Krishna's protection?
That's enough of a, to go in and face the guy is enough of a fear. Yeah. And on top of it, you have to think, am I, should I be doing this?
Yeah.
Well, what happened?
Well, we got the door open, and then it took a long time to get out. But the, anyways, there were seven police people surrounding me. So anyways, we eventually cut him out, but it was a scary situation. Hmm. But there's been a few situations like that in my work, and I'm always thinking, like, oh, am I under Krishna's protection now or not? And then the other thing that it made me think was, how do I ever know if I'm under Krishna's protection, even if I'm doing some service in the temple? Maybe I'm not doing it in the proper mentality, and maybe Krishna's not. It made me think.
You know, I don't think those fears are justified. Even if our chanting is mechanical or our service is impure or motivated, I don't think that's a cause of fear, because the process is so purifying. You should just go ahead and do it. Those are like needless fears. Like Krishna is saying, Mahasucha, don't be afraid. Do it, and this process will purify you. I think in the Catholic Church they call it a scrupulousness or over-scrupulousness, you know, worrying too much about these nitty-gritty moral principles rather than just surrendering to God and trusting in His love. How do we get hung up, you know, on these kind of things? Like, but although I myself have it, but I often hear it in the letters, you know, if my service is motivated or if this is like this, am I doing the right thing? And so much mental energy is used up. Just go ahead and do it.
One idea of fear, actually, after hearing it's a matter of, I think, mind bombs, but the opposite kind of line of fear that, that my attempts at Krishna conscious are actually overlooking things that I should be confronting or should be doing. There's a very easy tendency to apply the Krishna consciousness,
to be fearless.
That's just my karma. It's just what I have to. And then not deal with something that I should be dealt with, that come 20 years down the road.
Yeah.
Whack, it's come back on me. It's something I hadn't expected. So I would fear Krishna consciousness as an excuse or as a blinder or as blinkers in coping or dealing with things that I should be in, not something I should be doing when you're 60.
Yeah, that's the other side, like the side of the scale. Pokemon,
I was thinking one thing that I feel very fearful from is failure. And I kind of wonder, is there in failure in pleasing my mother or my service? And that could be on a very subtle level, like fear as a result of that, the one Krishna will either kick me away from that service or even me. But that fear of failure would be, I was thinking, I don't know if that's valid fear, like, because it's kind of Christian that thing.
Yeah, I think it's not valid. I think it's, you know, worrying too much about yourself and your own head, and rather than just offering your service to Krishna as best you can. There must be something earnest in what you're doing, and try to improve it. But you know, who's to judge that you failed? It's not, you can't judge it. And so, and somebody else really can't judge it except Krishna, and he's not going to judge, he's just going to accept the best you can do. I would put it in the category of another one of these things that we shouldn't be worrying about or shouldn't be afraid of. That I'm offering service, but maybe I'm fail. I have a sense of failure. Just take one more, Krishna Sundari.
I was wondering, I can imagine different kinds of fear that people are mentioning, but there's also, I think, a general kind of anxiety I experienced before I met the devotees and started chanting, almost like every morning waking up and just feeling anxiety until you realize you're not dead or nothing horrible is happening. And then when I started chanting, that went away.
Hmm.
And that's the first thing that chanting does, I believe, to take the anxiety away. And sometimes, you know, the days when I don't chant or something, actually comes back quite quickly, that general anxiety. I don't really know what they're scared of, but it's fearful. Just wondering, you know, when we get to that stage where we feel peaceful chanting and being with devotees and feel protected, could that be that we think we're doing okay because we don't feel that anxiety?
Well, that's. Well, wouldn't it be good on one level to have that? You know, every morning you wake up and you feel anxiety. Now that you're a devotee, you don't feel that. That's good. You sometimes have given counseling to devotees and friends. So, I think if they came to you and said like that, I'm always feeling anxiety. You would try to, for one thing, on a psychological level, you might try to explore it. You know, what's the cause of it, the anxiety. But material life itself is kind of a state of anxiety. That's what the atheist existentialist taught, you know, like Jean-Paul Sartre and Camus, that's our existential position, to be in anxiety. They said because life has no meaning, and sometimes you face that fact, and so you feel anxious. But you have to just take responsibility for your life and make the most out of it by, you know, enjoying yourself and doing good social work for others. But the anxiety is a fact because there's no God, there's no next life. So I think a person who is God conscious would naturally enter a state of peace, of feeling that shelter. Prabhupada put it so simply in the Bhagavad Gita purport as fear is to not know the future and fear is to be immersed in the material energy. So you're saying, or could it possibly be a kind of complacence? That's a different thing, but take it as an initial benefit of Krishna consciousness and then go on and try to improve your Krishna consciousness. But don't reject that peace that has come and trade it back for that constant anxiety or that anxiety that's underlying existence that drives people to a sinful life to try to make the anxiety go away, make more money, more sex life, more intoxication, make the anxiety go away. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.